Hey, welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, and I'm a contributing editor here at UX Magazine. I am joined by our resident AI visionary, Rob Wilson, the CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I co-authored the best-selling book, Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast is where we continue our explorations of agentic AI. Today, we're super excited to welcome Karen Howe, renowned tech journalist and author of the instant New York Times bestseller, Empire of AI. In her book, Karen distills more than a decade's worth of in-depth reporting into a detailed and highly readable account of OpenAI's dramatic rise to power that explores why leadership at the company abandoned the promise to keep their research open. We also talk about why their steadfast goal of being the first company to reach AGI is severely undercut by the lack of a clear definition of what artificial general intelligence even is. Now, this is another conversation where anthropomorphization comes into play, and we're going to talk about why making these tools behave more like humans is actually making them less effective and potentially more dangerous. Rob and I were both also intrigued by Karen's reporting on a small nonprofit in New Zealand that used AI to preserve the Maori language. By establishing a clear goal at the onset of their project, curating data in a responsible manner, they ably demonstrated how a more focused approach to integrating AI might win out over the blunt force of large language models. All right, this is a great episode, so get ready for a fascinating discussion with a real one, Karen Howe. I'm lucky because time doesn't exist in this void that I'm in, so...
I know. So yeah, you're in like awake. Kind of like a...
Yes. Yes.
At least I'm not wearing a totally black shirt, so you can kind of see me. Sometimes yeah, I'm just a floating head.
Josh is
a
Josh
feel like
is
you're
evolved.
Emerging from the metaverse. Like,
ooh.
Yes.
Well, Karen, first of all, we just wanted to congratulate you on the success of the book. We're both enjoying it quite a bit. Mine even has some water damage. I was reading it at a hot spring this weekend. Got rained on a little too.
That's amazing.
One thing that we were curious about, though, is, you know, this book does such an amazing job of exploring some of the problematic practices and decisions that are happening at the highest levels of AI research and development. And we were wondering if you have any sense of, you know, with the book's success, if the people that you're writing about in this book are reading it and are perhaps responding to it in you know, hopefully favorable ways, like maybe rethinking some of what they're doing a little bit, if you've had any interactions that indicate that that's happening at all.
I had a really interesting, I got some feedback from, not directly from a person working within OpenAI, but through kind of mutual people that we know, that the book has led to a lot of thought-provoking discussions and some feelings of being unsettled about, it has definitely caused some people to rethink whether or not they're in the right place, whether they're working on the right things, whether they're making the right decisions. But of course, it's also had the opposite effect where some people feel that they completely reject the book, the premise of it, everything, and they've just kind of dug their heels in more. So I think it's sort of had maybe a polarizing effect on the people within the companies in terms of how they receive it. Yeah.
It seems like maybe that was a theme in the reporting that went into the book too, where you were granted some access to OpenAI. You talked to a lot of people, you shared what you found, and maybe some people were sort of troubled by what they heard, and then other people were sort of going further in.
Yeah, well, the very first profile that I ever did of OpenAI for MIT Tech Review in 2020 was, it did have that polarizing effect. So there were some people that were extremely angry with my profile because it was critical of the company. And there were other people that I later learned, years later, as I started reporting the book, that loved the profile, but I didn't learn about that until I then ended up speaking with them and interviewing them for the book. And part of the reason why they were willing to talk to me in the first place was, oh, right, you were the person that wrote that profile that I thought was really accurate and fair. So I think my reporting in general for the people that I write about do have polarizing effects. I mean, it's not just been this book. I think I often take a really hard look and scrutinize things and people and decisions to a degree that makes some people uncomfortable and makes other people start to reflect and change their thoughts. You know, I've had some source relationships that I've developed over a very, very long time where after I wrote about them, when they were initially really pissed off at me, they then later come back 6 months, a year later and go, I think you actually had a point. And it now that I'm a little bit separated away from it, it's made me realize it's changed my perspective. It's opened up my worldview. So I've sort of gotten used to that kind of dichotomous reaction to my work within the Valley.
I feel like in some ways you went even light, you know, in some ways, like especially around the money thing, you know, and how much money was really a part of a lot of people's because truth has different lenses, truth has different perspective. Like things can be true and be yes and be no, right? And I think money tends to sway people into one version of the truth. And maybe they're not even conscious of it, right? And I think when it comes to the people within OpenAI, at least my perception while I was reading the book, you were kind of going easy on their financial success that was at stake with Sam Altman leaving. But I don't know, is that accurate? Were you going a little light there? I mean, in terms of like, oh, you know, we think he's a good guy and going to do the right thing versus like, I just planned buying a new house in the Bay Area, which I couldn't afford before.
Yeah, no, it's a really, I appreciate the fact that you picked up on that because it was something that I spent a lot of time thinking about is there's always a balancing act between reporting what people say to you exactly versus trying to figure out, you know, beneath the surface, whether there are preferences that are hidden.
Right.
And so a lot of people didn't bring up the money thing when I was talking with them about their decision-making calculus, or they would, you know, not bring it up for them, but say, oh, I have some coworkers where money was a really big role in their lives. And so then for, you know, many of the things that details in the book, I sort of had to make a judgment call at some point of, okay, do I literally transliterate what they told me, or
right.
do I add just a little bit more of my own analysis of what I think was also at play? And I think with OpenAI in particular, this is kind of a tricky thing because the leadership has done such a successful job of cultivating a mission and a higher purpose within the organization that everyone talks in coded language. People don't readily admit that they are working at the company for practical reasons, for financial reasons, or, you know, whatever it is. They will always talk in the language of, I'm really excited to build AGI and to bring this to all of humanity, and Sam Altman was the best leader to do that. You know, that's kind of how they speak. And so I did have to excavate a little and sometimes read between the lines. And so that's why in the end for the financial components, I highlighted it, but I didn't emphasize it that much to try and respect that balance of what people told me and also what I was sort of ascertaining from just the general dynamics and how I also know people are influenced, having worked in the tech industry myself, you know? So, there was a lot of striking the balance between what people said and what I analyzed.
This episode is supported through partnership with OneReach.ai. Their Generative Studio X platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Set up a runtime for AI agents that allows your organization to use any AI models, create customized guardrails, and avoid vendor lock-in, all with enterprise-grade security. OneReach.ai's award-winning GSX orchestration platform meets the many requirements needed to seize powerful new technologies in this pivotal moment. Learn more at OneReach.ai.
I guess it's a double-edged sword of a mission, you know? It's great to have a mission and you read some business book that says you should have a mission, but if you don't mean it, if it's just because you heard or read that you should have a mission, and that mission is like bold and to save humanity from itself is great, but then it doesn't allow you to talk about the real stuff and maybe even gains perspective, like, okay, let's talk about money then. And
yeah,
you know, you can't now because it's, you know, you're pretending that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, I wouldn't say that OpenAI talks about its mission in a while not believing it. I think it's actually more complicated than that, and that they believe in it so sure. much that they actually become blinded to their own their own true incentives for why they do things. And they end up wrapping a lot of their actions always around, but I'm ultimately doing it for the core of what I'm doing it is for the mission. And the challenge with OpenAI's mission in particular is that it's very ill-defined. Like, Google's mission, organize the world's information, that feels very concrete. Like, people generally have a consensus around what it means to organize and also what information is, you know, but
yeah,
there's no consensus around what it means to ensure, what AGI is, and also what benefits yeah. all of humanity is. So there's just yeah. squishiness all the way through.
It
and
is.
Therefore, it's just very vulnerable to yeah. interpretation
it's also,
every which way.
It's also less like, I'm going to save the world. You know,
yeah.
like we're the saviors of the world. Like we're, you know, it's just, we're going to organize information is a librarian. We don't usually see too many superhero librarians. And there's like the, you know, I'm going to save the world. We're going to build something great for humanity. And it's funny because we've had, you know, the folks from NVIDIA on the podcast and they're like, no, we're going to save humanity. We're the ones who made AI. You know, they're like, okay, oh, you're the ones. Yeah, no, they just used our chips. Like if it wasn't for us, you know, okay, oh, you're the superhero in this whole thing. And so there's a bit of like, okay, you discovered this, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, you don't control it. But when I looked at the New Zealand story, which I really appreciated that part of the book the most, it just felt right. You know, it's like I knew there was something wrong, but it wasn't until you told that story that I was like, that's what right looks like. And
yeah,
and they weren't like, we're gonna save the world. Right, we're going to help preserve this small little language that we, you know, that we love, and this is a
yeah.
tool to help us. And we're not going to make a lot of money, you know.
They don't make any money at all. Yeah, from the project.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't trying to scale it.
Right.
They weren't trying to scale it. Yeah. And the thing that's so radical. I remember when I first found that story, I was so struck by how radical it felt that they asked their community, do you want this AI tool before they built it? Mm-hmm. And then it made me really sad that I felt that that was radical. You know, it really did illustrate how much norms have changed that we don't even think about consent at all anymore as the first basic foundation for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they did that, and then when I share this story with people, I'm like, the first thing that they did was ask people if they want it, and then there's always audible gasps and laughs and acknowledgement, recognition, whatever, surprise of that being the first thing that they did. And it is just such an illustration of how embedded some of the problematic ideas around how should we develop technology and what purpose does technology serve has become embedded within the water of some of the ways that these companies operate.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too that they knew what they wanted to build. Like they had an idea for kind of exactly what they wanted to build to a degree where you make that great point in the book. I think you're talking to an AI researcher from China who says like, you know, this would have never happened here. Like, it's a very Silicon Valley thing to
yep.
give someone $1 billion to build something that they haven't even told you what it's going to be. So that was another question we had as we were thinking about the book. Like, did you feel like over time anyone was getting closer to a concrete definition of what AGI was, or what it was they were intending to build, or what form that might take? Because we're in this moment where we're told it's either going to save humanity or destroy it, but we also really don't know how that would happen or what it would even look like. You know, with the atomic bomb, obviously, it was quite a bit more visceral and real and tangible, but this feels so nebulous and, you know, has such fuzzy edges.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different crystallizations or definitions of what AGI is floating around now within OpenAI and also the broader industry, but they all kind of contradict each other, or just none of them are, they don't share characteristics. So like OpenAI writes in their formal mission statement that AGI is defined as highly autonomous systems that outperform humans in most economically valuable work. So that is a very distinctive definition that you can measure, and it's pegged to economic value. But then, you know, the information reported that in Microsoft and OpenAI's agreement, they agreed that AGI would be an AI system that successfully makes, I think it was $100 billion, which is just a totally different...
A little more honest, I mean, at least.
It's about money. some overlap. Yeah. And it's... And then there's also, you know, when Altman speaks to Congress, or he's speaking to the public, he's saying, oh, AGI is going to cure cancer and solve climate change. And that's yet again, a totally different benchmark for what AGI is, what purpose it's supposed to have. So that is, I think, part of the problem, is that, like, what I write in the book is, like, OpenAI can just decide what AGI is, whatever it wants. And it shifts both over time and among teams. So there are often, like, OpenAI has long had a joke: if you ask 13 people within the company what AGI is, you'll get 16 definitions. So they themselves know that this is not something that really has any kind of consensus or clarity.
Yeah. It's some sort of promise in the future to be better. And
yeah,
it's like, invest in us because we're getting better and we'll be better and it's going to be more amazing than it is. But in reality, it's already super intelligent in so many ways, and in other ways not. And it's just a different type of intelligence. It's just it's a dumb metric if you ask me, because it compares to a human, and that that anthropomorphic mode that we're in, you know, where we're skeuomorphic, whatever you want to call it, where we're comparing it to us constantly, is just a moment in time, because jobs were designed for us. And so,
yeah.
So it makes sense for a little while for it to, you know, be a simulation of humans, the same way like robotics having a human form factor makes sense because tools and jobs were made. But at some point we're like, why are we doing this? How do we reshape jobs for these things? And not for humans. So AGI just feels like this thing that's more nebulous than artificial intelligence now. It's like artificial intelligence wasn't like nebulous enough. We needed to come up with something more vague.
Absolutely. It is purposely confusing and usefully so.
We've talked before on this podcast, like when we've been exploring AGI, about this idea that it sort of represents the level of general intelligence that it requires for humans to be able to thrive all over the planet in all these different harsh conditions. But when I was thinking about that definition and reading your book, it occurs to me that isn't really what's happening, especially because of, I think you maybe call it digital colonialism that's taking place. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, if this intelligence, it is leaving out so much of the knowledge that's even knowledge that's buried in underrepresented languages and things like that, it's not really that kind of intelligence. It's not as broad as it's pretending to be if it really has kind of a narrow scope and data set and is biased, right?
Yeah, this is something that I think, I feel like the AI world runs on so many linguistic tricks where they coin all these terms to make it appear as if there's more than there actually is. So I 100% agree. The idea that there is some kind of generalization happening within these tools is actually not substantiated by evidence, because the moment you move away from the English language, even into another dominant language like Spanish, the tool already starts to break down. Like, that's not generality. And the fact that it doesn't understand certain cultures, certain histories, like there was a test that Proof News, outlet started by Julia Engwin, did, where they asked a history teacher to quiz ChatGPT on Black history, and it just totally failed basic facts and figures from Black history. So that's, yeah, we're not actually talking about systems that have true generality and are probably not going to get to true generality, because the way that the industry is approaching developing these tools right now, or these systems right now, is using extraordinary amounts of data. And there's actually very few languages, communities in general that actually reach that data imperative. You know, like, it's really only the internet giants that have that much data sitting around to fulfill the requirements of these models. The manufacturing industry doesn't have that amount of data. The healthcare industry doesn't have that amount of data. You know, pretty much every other sector is dealing with data scarce environments. And so how are you going to get to some generality with a brute force, more and more and more and more data approach, when actually most of the world and most businesses do not operate in that paradigm?
Yeah, I am. I don't know. For some reason in this conversation, my head keeps going back to the fact that, I guess, how dumb we are. Like, we just keep thinking these are fake humans. They're like, they're human. I kind of told this story, like, I imagine like two people sitting on a park bench, you know, and two birds chirping at each other in a tree. And you're sort of looking at the two birds going, I wonder what they're talking about. And then, like, somebody replaces one bird with a speaker, you know, and it's just a speaker chirping and another bird. And then the people going like, oh my God, it thinks it's a bird, you know? And then one person leaves the park bench and starts talking to ChatGPT, and the bird's like, oh my God, it thinks it's a human. You know, like, it's not a human, you know? And we do, just because we're talking to this technology, right, we're starting to anthropomorphize it and think that it is human. I think it can confuse A, the dangers, right? And B, like, the actual ways that it can be used to help. Like in this New Zealand example, they weren't trying to create another native member of their tribe, right?
Their tribe.
They were like, oh, we don't have enough members. Let's get some AI members so we can increase the numbers, you know? They were like,
they talked to Mark Zuckerberg and were like, oh my God, AI friends, AI tribe.
Yeah, look at our Facebook page is growing in numbers. They were trying to preserve the language, which is what this thing does really well, as language. It's so clear on its purpose, and it's such a tool, you know, in this regard. And I just, I wonder, like, when do we get past this? It's kind of like, as designers, you know, we used to, it's stupid simple, but we used to have to make calculators on the iPhone have drop shadows and look like real buttons, because people couldn't tell that you're meant to press them, right? But then eventually, like, they go to flat design, where, why are we doing all of this to make it look like a real calculator, you know? And then we go to flat design, where, you know, it's just simple, and it even looks more like a spreadsheet than it does a calculator anymore. And I just wonder, it makes me wonder, like, will we pass this phase anytime soon, where we start looking at it really as a tool and stop talking about it in terms of intelligence and artificial human, and just say, this is a machine, and an interface, a user interface that can use language versus graphical interfaces. And it's another way to put an interface in front of a computer that's still going to have a lot of deterministic components to it, even if those deterministic components are happening on the fly. Even if that code's being written in real time, it's still code that's being written, it's still logic, and it's still operating machines, not and software. It's not human or thinking, or it's not one thing, you know, it's not a thing that can think and talk. I don't know.
Yeah.
Going down a hole here, but it just...
No, I just can't.
I'm always surprised that OpenAI is so anthropomorphic. That's what always shocks me. Like, how are they so anthropomorphic internally?
Well, and they lean into it to go back to this idea that design, like, you can either design these systems to highly anthropomorphize them, or you can design them just to turn them into tools, right? Like, and
yes.
OpenAI throughout its history has chosen specific design decisions to make it feel more anthropomorphic. So when they first released GPT-2, I want to say, they thought quite a lot about how the text should come out generated. So they tested like all these different things, like just the block of text suddenly appears on your screen, or it comes out sort of one by one by one. And they realized that the latter made it feel like the machine was thinking. So they chose that, which is like, yeah. And then when with ChatGPT, of course, they chose a chat interface, which in the history of AI, chat interfaces are the things that are the most compelling to users and make them ensnare them in a trap of anthropomorphization. And then, of course, they add a teeny tiny little piece of disclaimer text in small font on ChatGPT. The answers might not always be correct. You know, like
these to
are
compensate.
These were all very, very intentional design decisions that they spent time thinking about, A/B tested, user tested, to hone that kind of anthropomorphization.
Right. Yeah. And then said, maybe we went too far. Let's put in a disclaimer. let's not back off though. Let's put it in a disclaimer so we don't get in trouble. Like it was, you know, get the best voice. It's so realistic, laughing and complimenting and it just I guess that's where the hypocritical part comes in for me, is if your mission is truly your mission, then just be a machine. Be honest with people and say, I'm a machine, but I'm super good at talking, you know, but you know, you have to turn that on. You have to ask for that. And if you as the user, I think of so many laws that are designed around like the act of machines trying to mimic humans or pretending to be humans. Like that's what's wrong, right? If somebody calls and robocalls you and pretends to be a human, that's what we make against the, that's where we draw the line, right? And I just wonder if that should be the ethical line, is the deception of whether it's overt or just like you said, you know, trying to subtly trick people's brains into thinking it's human without saying it. I wonder if that's where the line is, you know, in one respect.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like part of the challenge is that people within OpenAI really do believe that general intelligence is possible. So they really do believe that there will one day be artificial humans and that they are on the path to building it. So I think sometimes the decisions are, like, it is aligned with their worldview and their beliefs of what they think that they are doing. But the problem is that they're not then thinking about how this will change human-computer interaction in potentially deleterious ways. They're kind of just thinking about, like, what is the best way for me to manifest this dream that we collectively share within this organization?
Yeah.
And, like, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that they constantly talk about the movie Her as a concrete touchstone of let's try to go for that. And that also orients a lot of their design decisions. You know, they do try to make it feel playful and flirty and evocative and emotive and, you know, all these things, because that's their, in their mind, it's like anchored, their idea of general intelligence is anchored to that movie.
We've joked that at the very least, these systems could refer to themselves in the third person to help alienate them from people a little bit, because that tends to make people uncomfortable.
I mean,
Josh is enjoying this conversation.
Yes.
Josh is having a good time.
Yeah,
like there's so many different design decisions that they could choose to just like add a little bit of that uncanny valley feeling to remind people, oh, right, this is the machine, the tool. But they obviously that they're not really incentivized to do that.
And we were talking to Anne Lemke. She's like a, you know, expert around addiction and dopamine, best-selling author like yourself. And she talks about AI being like the next big addiction. And and I feel like there's a lot, it makes a lot of sense, right? Because at the end of the day, this level of anthropomorphization is really dopamine, it's dopaminergic, right? We can get addicted to this stuff. And it's just another like doom scroll thing at some level, like getting people addicted to this technology so they talk to it more and conversations go on longer. And you're like, well, it's kind of a strange objective, right? Instead of like just to be useful to, and I think it makes sense in gaming, right? So in UX, we have this like clear line between you're designing for entertainment, you're designing for practicality. And the key is though, you know, we tend to know which mode we're in. And because when you're designing a game and someone throws like the controller across the room, that's success. You know, when you're designing something from a productivity level, that's failure. And and people have signed up to be engaged, you know, in one regard. So yeah, I keep coming back to being shocked. And I think, I guess that's where everybody's at, is this wasn't as planned a discovery. You know, I guess very few are, but this wasn't really, we didn't have a lot of time to prepare, right? And here we are in this anthropomorphic phase. And yeah, I just wonder how we get, maybe that's just part of the puzzle of getting out of it, is to design these tools to look like tools.
I think so. I think that is going to be a really big part of it. Yeah. And also, and that's not just a user interface, like the user interface details, but the model itself, you know, trying to pursue models that have voice capabilities in the first place, or that that OpenAI continues to say is reaching general intelligence. To your point, like the Maori people in New Zealand, they weren't trying to, never once did they say, like, let's try to build an AI that's going to recreate a tribe member. They were like, let's just create a speech recognition tool. So that they chose a totally different AI model to pursue. And so that in and of itself needs to change, I think, because there is something inherently problematic, I think, about trying to pursue general intelligence for various reasons. One, that we already have humans. Why are we trying to replace them? We've long had relationships with computers, computational technology, where the computers do things that we are not good at. So why are we trying to now use them to do the things that we are good at, instead of just keeping them doing the things that they're good at, and then we do the things that we're good at? But also just what I mentioned, that generality is not actually happening. That is not what's actually being achieved. So there is a looseness in people's understanding of what these tools can actually do. And then on top of that, then you layer all of the other user interface, user experience things that add even more bells and whistles that confuse people.
Yeah. And I think your point in the book is, you know, the nature of pursuing generality is a lot of waste, electricity, you know, like you don't need this big model for a lot of things. But we think general intelligence makes sense for a company that wants to simplify and make a lot of money on a model. Like, why not have a hammer that can be used for so many things? That makes sense, right? And they want to sell that to a lot of people, and they don't have to think about use cases. You know, they just, it's good for everything. It's like the elixir, right? It's just, it cures everything. I can see
exactly
why that commercially makes sense, but
it really has morphine
really,
in it.
To your point, like if you know what you need the thing for, like in that example, then you don't need to waste all of that electricity, you know, and compute. You're not, it doesn't need to be generally intelligent. It just needs to preserve this language.
And I think it's interesting. I've spoken with startups who have realized that there's actually a pretty big gap in the market for developing more specific AI models for enterprise use cases, because inevitably after the hype dies down, healthcare company will realize that they don't need an everything machine. They just need an AI tool that does healthcare really, really well. And then why are they paying for 90% of the extra gunk? And so I've talked to startups who are already moving into the, we're going to develop the 10% tool because healthcare only needs healthcare, education only needs education, whatever other manufacturing only needs manufacturing, and we're going to cut out all the fat and sell technologies for far cheaper with higher quality data, with much more rigorous testing and reliability and all these things. And that is, I think, ultimately where we're going to shift as companies become more familiar with what AI is, the flaws that it can have, and start actually scoping out when they actually need this technology. But in the interim, while everyone is just in a frenzy of, oh my God, I need an AI strategy, buying the everything machine sounds pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a story of a woman who married the Eiffel Tower. And so I think, you know, and people who like married their alarm clocks. And I think like, great, there'll always be a place for people who want to marry objects or have relationships with things, you know?
Like they can have deeper relationships with things now.
Yeah, let that be, you know, a use case.
It seems like with AGI, the idea of AGI too, like even a really rudimentary version of AGI would probably pretty quickly be able to diagnose like the key problem standing in the way of humans solving all these complex problems. And to me, it seems like it's greed, and it's sort of the corruption that comes with like this thirst for power. I mean, and as we were reading this book, we were talking about Lord of the Rings and about kind of the one ring to rule them all and how it's like too powerful for any one person to hold on to. And it almost feels like that's what's playing out here, because it's horribly inefficient to have all these massive competing models like burning through energy and water when it could be done more collaboratively. Is that what has to happen? Is someone throws this into the fire, or that people might be able to make all this AI work for us instead of against us?
Well, I mean, I think that's what the open source movement is all about, is you create one model and then you give it to everyone. And the reason why we end up having so much inefficiency with closed source approaches is that those people aren't going to give you their model to modify in the ways that you want to. So the only thing you can do is just train another model. Whereas with open source, you download someone already used all that energy, they used all that water, they developed the thing, and now you really just need a few adjustments. You download the model and you modify it, and that already saved like a huge amount of the inefficiencies. So I do think that one of the solutions among many in terms of like how we get out of this vicious cycle is to lean more into open source development and have that collaborative community-based approach where people are building off of one another's work without duplicating each other left and right.
Yeah. It's that tough tension between capital. It is, you know, capital intensive to pursue what they're calling AGI. And then this idea that, you know, we want to open source and share it. And I guess it's like the perfect example of something that, you know, I think a lot of even countries might get together and do, but it's not uncommon. You know, we have plenty of examples in science where, you know, countries invest a lot of money to discover. We just somehow don't apply it in this case, I think, because of how it emerged, right? And I think your point in the book is it could have gone two ways, right? It could have gone leaning into the OpenAI original intent, which is to make it open and try to do what, you know, folks in physics have done and raise money at the government level and make something to serve all of humanity. And it could have leaned towards, you know, making money. And one of the questions I have, I mean, they made the choice, right? This is the only way we're going to get the capital. Okay, fine. Despite examples of others doing it, they said it's the only way. Okay, but now it's open source. Some, you know, Facebook open sources. Now why not? You know, why close it? Once the cat's out of the bag, what are you protecting? What is it that they believe theirs is so much more powerful than the others? Is that essentially where it's at?
Yeah, I mean, there's two main driving motivations for why they continue to keep it closed. One is that there are factions within the company that still believe that they're on the path to general intelligence that could potentially go rogue, and therefore open sourcing a rogue AI on the internet would be devastating, could potentially have devastating effects. And, you know, there are a lot of criticisms of that particular camp of thought, one of which is that there are an extraordinary amount of open source models that have basically replicated most of the capabilities of closed source models, and that hasn't happened. So you would think that that's not really a valid argument anymore. But the other one is just that they need to continue creating a perception that their models are worth paying for so that they can recoup all of the costs that they sunk into developing it. And so if, you know, if they open source it and you suddenly realize that the model is not that impressive, because now researchers can start studying the limitations of the model, they can start tinkering with it, people can start modifying it, whatever, then suddenly the value of the company significantly depreciates.
Yeah.
And so there is also a motivation to continue maintaining the mystique, I guess, of what the model actually is and can do.
It's suddenly occurring to me in this conversation, which is weird that it took this long, but when we were talking to NVIDIA, as I mentioned before, Jensen Huang and folks at NVIDIA, like, they've always sort of found the sort of outliers, the nerds that, you know, gamers, you know, they sold their chips to gamers, and I think they kind of pointed out that AI in the day, you know, so if you look at some of the folks we've had on the show and you look back at, you know, my career, you know, AI was a bit of a weird community. It wasn't mainstream physics, right? It wasn't something that was regarded as, you know, institutional in a way. And even down to like figuring out that the NVIDIA chip would work was like something a bunch of hackers were doing, right? And they kind of point out that AI is like a hacker discovery. It's not a mainstream discovery from, you know, out of some university. And maybe I think it's funny. I think like now it's occurring to me that path of being a bunch of misfits in AI was kind of the challenge to get funding in more of a science traditional way. Maybe that sort of disregarding it as a real science, you know, as an important thing, you know, we have all of these major examples of you know, science investment down to like NASA, right? Like there's no way you can't get money for something important, but maybe it just comes down to the hackerness of it. I don't know. It just occurred to me like, yeah, I guess nobody wants to give a bunch of misfits $1 billion.
Well, I think back then $1 billion was still considered an extraordinary amount of money. Now it feels increasingly by the day like it's a small amount of money compared to some of the things that amounts that people are raising now. But I think it was just $1 billion for what to anyone would have been odd.
Right.
You know, but OpenAI successfully pulled it off in part because they had Elon Musk at the beginning and then Sam Altman, who is just really, really good at what Musk himself had a lot of money to kind of toss around. And then Altman was just really, really good at continuing to fundraise more.
And that was just his jam, right? I mean, that's just his path, his comfort zone, fundraise that way. He wasn't a physics laureate or something like that that could go raise money for research. So I guess that choice, right? Set it on its path.
It is a choice for sure. Yeah. I mean, he found his talent in fundraising and he's taken a career path that has leaned into his strengths. I mean, you know, that's the advice that everyone gets in their career, like identify your strengths early and then exploit them. And he did that very effectively. He became an investor, which is being able to fundraise a lot and be have a wide ranging portfolio is, of course, definitely a huge strength as an investor. And then he became the CEO of the one AI company that sort of made its name based on the amount of money it had sitting around.
Yeah.
So yet again, he ended up exploiting his strengths in that regard.
I don't want to lose you before talking about one thing in the book that struck me more so. I mean, I'd heard it, but it really kind of hit home, was how much they put into recruiting, how much recruiting was just a major part. It wasn't, you know, Sam Altman in a lab coat discovering AI, right? Like maybe some people think it was them on a bus going to Napa, right? and I mean, recruiting was a really big part of this, was it not?
Yeah, and it's come full circle because now, like, with the talent wars and, like, Meta, now Mark Zuckerberg is doing the whole recruiting game and poaching all of these AI researchers by cold emailing them personally. But I think within the AI world, there's always been this understanding that first, before you need capital, you need talent. And if you don't have the talent, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at the thing, it's just not going to manifest into any kind of usable AI model. I think that is increasingly, maybe not, but I'm starting to get the sense that is starting to become less true with the particular approach that the companies have taken, which is just scaling existing techniques. Like that, like originally when OpenAI was recruiting, they were thinking that they could potentially be doing fundamental research and need research breakthroughs. So from that perspective, they needed extremely good scientific talent. And there were only so many AI researchers at the time that had PhDs, that had been doing this for a really long time, that had a track record of breakthroughs. And they went after all of them, basically. And the most key one being Ilya Sutskever. He was at the time already very, very famous as an AI researcher and had already had at least three major breakthroughs by the time that OpenAI went to poach him from Google.
And that was NVIDIA's approach too, I think, right? Like they called it the brain extraction. Like that's kind of how they carved out their space in the marketplace. They would just take the top three people from every competitor and strip them away and then watch those competitors wither and die.
That's
yeah,
funny.
The other guys invented AI.
Yeah, the hardware side.
Yeah, I think it is. It is a very... It's an effective strategy because good people want to work with other good people. If you form a talent-dense team from the beginning, it kind of then self-perpetuates. And that's one of the things that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is trying to do with Meta now. He's not just poaching single people. He's poaching people in like clusters from different companies. There was a really good piece in the Wall Street Journal that was talking about how the people that are getting poached, these AI researchers that are very senior and they know that they're the hot talent on the market, their allegiance is actually to one another rather than to any company. So their negotiation tactics all revolve around making sure that they come as a package. And that is both very effective in suddenly getting a ton of talent on your side and also in kneecapping your competitors by gouging out a bunch of their talent. So,
well, I was thinking about what you were saying about startups kind of focusing on this 10% tool approach. And it occurs to me that if that becomes sort of more the way that people start using or enterprises or companies start using AI, that by virtue like makes it more of a tool, but it also could also set the stage for maybe a more robust type of general intelligence, right? If you have all these AI tools that are specialists in certain industries, and then also, you know, like kind of how with the Maori people, like they were able to create a specialized AI that preserved a language. If you have all these smaller focused tools that are obviously able to collaborate with one another through natural language, then maybe you have something closer to a real useful sort of AGI, perhaps. It kind of jives with what we talk about in our book, like the idea of organizational artificial general intelligence, that the amount of general intelligence required to run a company is much, much more manageable than trying to create some sort of system that can do everything people can do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's actually kind of a equivalent within the AI research world. It's called mixture of experts. Like mixture of expert models are models that are not trained to be. Usually you train a model where all of the neurons are connected together. So it's like a very densely connected neural network. And with mixture of experts, you actually train different parts of the network to be specialized in different things. And then ultimately as an amalgamation, it's much more capable, but it's not like not all of the neurons in the neural network are lighting up every single query. It's just the parts that it needs to answer the thing. So yeah, I think you're onto something in the sense that could actually just be a more robust general intelligence. I think I would still kind of ask, like, why do we really need at that point a general intelligence? Like maybe we want to continue having aggregations of different models based on more complex problems or tasks that we need to perform, but ultimately, I kind of like the idea of like different communities having different models rather than the entire world trying to create some kind of one size fits all solution for everyone.
Yeah. We're just trying to hijack the AGI and say, let's go narrow. There's a thing at NASA with digital twins, which is like only the fidelity of your digital twin should be, you know, only relative to the use case and just enough. You shouldn't try to build out a digital twin that's, and so we're trying to say OGI is like just enough intelligence instead of as much as you can get.
That is exactly,
all the intelligence.
That is exactly what we need.
Yeah. Well, cool. I don't want to keep you up. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations again on the success with the book. Definitely well-deserved.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the US and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.